Okay, hello, and welcome to the Tenet podcast. No, I'm kidding. Today we have a cult classic, and dare I say a divisive film on the pod.
Could be.
We actually have a ton of news for this episode, even though we've been in lockdown. Mainly it's the fact that Christopher Nolan's film Tenet has got a trailer out for it, but there are lots of other things to talk about. I think as the main character of today's film would say in 2020, we want the finest podcast hosts available to humanity. We want them here and we want them now. So I'm joined by Louis.
We've done a podcast by mistake.
And Benas.
Hey.
We're not joined by Sparrow this episode because, ironically, I think he might be quite hungover.
Perfect.
It feels like the perfect episode to actually come on for that.
Could be a reason why. Ah, no, I don't want to spoil. We'll get to that later about hangovers and watching films.
What do you know, Benas?
spoilers ahead. I was actually listening back to one of our old episodes, and the amount of times that we got 40 minutes in, we were like, oh yeah, by the way, spoilers. I feel bad that I didn't actually have a drink or I was drunk while I was watching this film. That would actually have made quite a big difference to my viewing experience.
Made a difference, yeah.
I think I watched this film for the first time at school, like in class at school.
Drunk?
No, like actually like a teacher played it. It was a bit of a weird way into a film like that. But yeah, I think the perfect way is probably whiskey in hand or lighter fluid in hand, depending on what you like.
Benas, you've watched an insane amount of movies.
I did. My
record on the Dylan episode where I...
When you just run off. Not surprised though. You're always fucking watching something.
Dare I say a little bit more TV than film since the last time we spoke. The only films I've actually watched are Beautiful by Alejandro Iñárritu.
Yeah.
And La Strada by Fellini.
Yeah, I can probably say that is all movie, is it? Because Beautiful
yeah,
was on the...
It's all movie. It's all movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Beautiful was an amazing movie, but it was long, so long, but I think it's Javier Bardem's best.
Yeah.
Best performance.
Yeah, it's fantastic. That was in my top 10 of the decade.
Really? Oh yeah, it was.
Very quiet performance though, like strong. Yeah, I watched quite a few. And also, there's one that didn't make the list, which was Come and See This, or Come and... The Russian...
Oh, did you watch that?
Yeah, I did, this morning, which was... I was like, why am I doing this? Because it's a slow pace, kind of like Stalker, kind of similar apocalyptic kind of views into it, I suppose. Whereas this one, like, really depicts the Second World War for Belarusians.
So this is Come and See, right? That's
yeah,
the title. It's meant to be one of the most harrowing war films ever made.
And you know, for the first like 40-45 minutes, it's kind of like, okay, this is, you know, it's not great, but nothing extremely bad is shown. And then it's like a Mel Gibson film then just kind of derails, man. Strong, as in, yeah, I would definitely recommend it to watch at least once in your life. Yeah, for sure. Took quite a while to make, I think. Not surprised, actually, to see Lithuanian actors in that film.
I feel like Lithuania is always the go-to when it's like, needs to be Russia, but...
But not Russia. Yeah, because yeah. You can't run a film in Russia.
Yeah, because loads of Chernobyl was filmed in Lithuania, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was definitely an interesting one to watch. But I also kind of watched a lot more indies this time. But the one that stood out for me, which was another directorial debut from Clark Duke, Arkansas. That was it was a strong debut. Maybe not as strong as I kind of wanted, but it was like, I think it's 2 hours. So for a directorial debut, that is a long kind of film to sustain. Because usually what they range in about 120, 130 tops. But also funny and good performances from like John Malkovich and shit. It's weird to see kind of like those big established actors in these small indie films like Malkovich or Vince Vaughn was in it.
I feel like sometimes when actors make it big, it's then like you do like a quick reversal to a small indie to like cement your acting
cred. To get some cred, yeah. Now he's all Hollywood.
Yeah. It's like, hey, I did this £10,000 budget film, right? Didn't even have a trailer, for God's sake.
It's like they're queuing up outside of like budget directors' offices.
Yeah.
Come on, I want the credibility.
You're like, yeah, the budget's £5,000. That's way too high for this indie. Needs to be way lower. Louis, you've been watching our friend from Fisherman's Friends.
He's so fucking hungover. I'm a bit like you. I haven't really been watching much film. I've been watching TV series, you know, because I guess in lockdown that sort of stuff just is a bit more. You can kind of like wring more out of a series than you can out of a film. Yeah, I can't say I've been watching anything kind of breathtakingly good, but one of the things I'm watching at the moment is called White Lines on Netflix, which is obviously something that was filmed to kind of come out. It was kind of timed, I think, to come out when everyone was going to be going on their summer holidays, because it's a real sort of and it's a real kind of like, you know, dreamy setting on the beach. And now it's more just like a sadistic look at, you know, what it would be like if people could go on their summer holiday.
Yeah, because everyone's vicariously living their holiday through.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, wouldn't this be nice? But no, it's quite funny. It's quite silly, but it's quite good. Yeah, it's like, you know, I'm reserving my full judgment. I'm only about 3.5 episodes in.
Ben has made it 10 minutes in and decided it wasn't.
I really don't blame you. The first episode, you are a bit like, yeah, this is not going to be worth time.
I have that problem with so many things, like just so like Killing Eve, I had to like retry again. So with Killing Eve, I was like essentially is the pilot. A friend of mine, she forced me to sit there and just watch another episode. And then at like, I think it was like 11 at night, she's like, okay, I'm off to bed. I'm like, I'll stick around.
You're like, you're really into film and you know a lot about film. And that's sort of like, I wonder if it's kind of like your rhythm that you're used to for a narrative to build is kind of film rhythm, where you wouldn't be given like an hour to sort of just get into it.
Not unless come by Tarkovsky, I suppose. You wouldn't get that much time to like ease it.
Tarkovsky is shooting like 10-hour TV episodes in one film, which I've got so much time for. So Tenet trailer.
Oh yeah,
it's coming out tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. At the end of it, it says coming to theaters, which is a sort of Nolan flex.
The only film.
Is the word theaters in like double size font? Being like, definitely going to be theaters. Theaters.
I'm at. Yeah.
Theater. Coming to theaters. Unsurprisingly, I think this looks wicked, and I'm really excited for it, as I'm sure everyone else is.
Oh yeah,
I think the
sure.
only people that aren't excited about it are people that like just purposely want to go against the grain, because it's hard not to like his films these days.
It looks interesting. It looks bloody confusing. If the trailer's anything to go by.
Love the trailers for his films, because they are a little bit of misdirection in themselves, whereas I feel like a lot of trailers these days kind of give you the whole thing or they give you completely nothing. And I don't feel like this trailer doesn't give you nothing. It just gives you everything in the most confusing way possible. You know that we're there, front row IMAX with gas masks on. If it comes up. One of my friends was like, we need to go as Bane. That's a genius idea. That's actually a genius idea.
Oh my god, Bane themed masks.
Good luck finding those. Apparently those are sold out recently. I read it in the news that those masks are sold out.
And so many fancy dress parties going on.
Who's doing that? Yeah.
The authorities were just like, those are just like for dress up. Those aren't actual masks. You can't really wear those. Weird. I know.
You're going to have to pull me away from this conversation, because I could talk about Tenet for the rest of this whole
You were joking when you said the Tenet podcast. You never forget your first Tenet.
It does segue slightly into this whole conversation about the Oscars potentially being moved, or I think they are being moved.
Definitely strong chat.
And the Venice Film Festival, which is meant to be in September.
Mm-hmm.
Is going ahead. The director of the festival is adamant it's going to take place. So it does, all this kind of when do cinemas reopen and when is it safe is kind of a big topic of discussion at the moment in the film industry.
I was going to say, I've never been to the Venice Film Festival, believe it or not, but is it, do you go to loads of cinemas and watch films, or is it just like you go and you listen to talks about films, or just, you know, do events and things?
Both.
I think it's both. They would have like workshops and stuff like that, but Venice just has a bit more panache, mainly because that's the film festival that usually kind of deep, like La La Land debuted there, First Man debuted there, and it kind of launches off big careers. And
Joker as well.
Joker, yeah. And those go on to do the Oscars circuit anyways. So that's a good indication of what wins there. Kind of will probably go on to win some one or two Oscars. Yeah, right. So
it's kind of interesting how the Venice Film Festival is in September and it's supposedly going ahead and the Oscars is next February, and they think you're pushing it back to to May.
Which,
with Anas and I were chatting earlier, it really screws around with like what films are eligible for the Oscars. What you know, because if you did it currently, you'd have like Men in Black 3 winning.
What, you got a problem with that?
I asked a friend what was the last film he watched in the cinema. He said he watched Bad Boys. So
whoa,
yeah.
Oh, sorry, I meant Bad Boys 3.
So, if you can't call off the Oscars, which I don't think I'd have a big problem with that, but I'm sure then the calendars get just way too stuffed with films that the turnaround would have to be quicker, and some films won't even get to be in theaters because they're looking at what will make the most money either way. They just want to make back as much money that they've lost.
Imagine how crowded 2022 would be.
As an Oscars and just as general as a year. I wonder which films will come out the strongest though out of this. So will it be the kind of superhero kind of complete, you know, you don't have to think about life? Or will it be the more indies, you know, that kind of have some sort of life reflection?
I don't know if it's necessarily an either or. I feel like any form of escapism, you know, is going to be well needed after everyone has been stuck inside.
You say that, but so, for example, recently, I had an email from an exec, and he was like, any virus-related films, no, they don't want, fair, because, you know, who's going to be like, yeah, so I was just stuck indoors for like half a year, and now I'm going to go watch what happened to me whilst I was indoors.
also for the people making those films, we just spent a year inside. Now I'm going to spend another 2 years making this film, of which I'm going to have to live in this headspace again.
The crew would still have to reel off that, because obviously when productions go back, you know, they would have to be tested like temperatures or whatever, so everyone, it'd be so meta making that film.
So meta, yeah.
You're still feeling the effects of the thing that you're making about. So
there'll be a slew of them, won't there? But it'll probably be in like 10 years time, 20 years time, whatever.
I hope they're all VOD or some shit. Contagion was enough, I think.
By the way, some of these memes coming about Tenet are so funny.
Dennis Rodman.
Oh, I love that meme.
That one is so good.
It's like Christopher Nolan explaining the Tenet timeline, and then someone's taken a clip from The Last Dance, actually, which is another series I've been watching, and it's Dennis Rodman like explaining that how they play basketball, and he's like, go over here, and you go over there, and then this thing comes over here.
Click, boom.
Click, boom, and then this goes here.
It's like, that is genius, so well timed. Yeah.
Speaking of The Last Dance, has been one of the best things I've seen on Netflix in such a long time, the Michael Jordan series. Should we move on to this week's film,
which is
With Nail and I, if you didn't already know by clicking on this episode. So this is Bruce Robinson's directorial debut. It was made in 1987, and the tagline for it is, in 1969, two substance abusing unemployed actors retreat to the countryside for a holiday that proves disastrous.
Quick question, not so much of a question, but just a little bit more Tenet related here again. So it was made in 1987 or 1986, about
1987, yeah.
And about 1969, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I was just about... Okay, cool. No.
Yeah, it's not in 1989.
Dennis Rodman.
Lou, this is one of your favorites, right?
This holds a special place in my heart because I loved it when I was probably like late teens. And I think I loved it then, just, let's be honest, mostly because of it. It was so kind of quotable, so funny, and quite kind of like schoolboy humor, because, you know, it's jokes about, oh, it's hilarious, the language is really funny, the swearing is really funny, and the fact that like they're all hungover and pissed all the time, and you can kind of giggle about that with your friends and all that stuff. And I remember, that was why it kind of, I guess, stuck with me, or like first hooked me when I was younger. But I think watching it again later in life, I'm a bit more kind of the old man that I am. I kind of relate to it on a different level now, because the characters are 29, I'm 29, and it's set in 1969. It's sort of about the end of
and
youth.
It's 1969 right now. Little bitch.
It's the end of the world now. So I don't know. So it's still hilarious, but it kind of has new meaning, because really it's a film about the end of, not the end of youth full stop, but kind of the end of that kind of chaotic period in your 20s. Or the 1960s, or both.
Yeah, because Richard E. Grant was 29 when I think he filmed this.
Yeah. And
yeah, there is a kind of sense of like leaving that
a decade behind. Yeah.
Doesn't he have a line there where he's just like, "I'm about to turn 30, Richard E. Grant"?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he does. When they do reference it.
Yeah, fair enough. I didn't know he was 29.
So I feel like he looked like he did in With Nail for like some time, and then he just looks like he does now.
Yeah, you're old now.
Yeah. It's an interesting director's debut in that out of the ones we've done so far, I feel like it might be sort of the most famous work of that director. Mm. It kind of has overshadowed all their other work. I mean, I only really know that he did the How to Get Ahead in Advertising film, and then he did the Rum Diary, I think, with Johnny Depp. But I mean, when you're talking about films that people are going to remember Bruce Robertson by, it's going to be I think it's going to be with Nan and I, right?
I was going to say, I guess partly because it's sort of semi-autobiographical, really, isn't it? It's he talks a lot about how basically he is the I character, as it were. Like, he went through this experience himself.
So it's based on his own book, though, no?
Yeah, it's started, the script or the story or whatever started as an unpublished novel by him, right?
Yeah, like The Dark Times or whatever. So it was a semi-autobiographical.
I mean, I'd seen this once before and I couldn't remember it at all. And then when I rewatched it, I kind of remembered bits of it, but I basically saw it new. This film, I've always heard it to be lots of people's favorite film, and kind of it's become a cult classic through people rediscovering it. I also think when it came out, it apparently didn't have a very good theatrical run. I don't know if this is true, but I did read one anecdote that the very first screening of it with Bruce Robinson there was to a bunch of people where no one laughed for the whole time.
And
he later found out that it was a bunch of German tourists who were watching it. And he was like, "Oh, well, that's fine. Of course it's funny if the Germans don't find it funny." I hope that's true.
But it does split opinion, even if you do speak English. It does.
Yes.
A lot of people who just don't find it funny, including the person who's noticeable by their absence on this podcast right now.
Yeah. I'm amazed that Sparrow doesn't like this film. I feel like it's got all the things that he would like in a movie. But
yeah, sure.
We'll let the man speak.
That's it.
I'm grilling him about two things next episode: his recent love of David Robert Mitchell and why he doesn't like With Nail and I. But yeah, so this is semi autobiographical because With Nail, Richard E. Grant's character, and we should say he's also. And I is played by Paul McGann, I think. With Nail is based on a real actor. I think the guy that Robinson lived with, called Vivian Mackerel, supposedly did actually drink lighter fluid, which became the inspiration for that scene where he drinks it. So yeah, it's interesting to think that With Nail was ever a real person, just with the absurdity of this movie.
I don't know, I can see it. I can see it. Yeah, I first. Okay, so this was my first time watching it, and so it's interesting to hear that this film is a cult classic. I feel like it's a cult classic. I don't know whether it's among a broader scope of people that like film, or is it just inside, like if you grew up in England, maybe, or because I've never heard of this film before. I've heard of Bruce Robinson before. Well, when I watched it, I watched it very severely hungover, this film is slow and it doesn't really go anywhere. It's very ambiguous in the sense of like, okay, so they kind of take that trip to the countryside to escape like this. Not sitting.
And they get hunted by Uncle Monty.
Yeah, that was just like super weird, and almost I didn't really understand that side until I read more about this film. Okay, it's like, okay, so this wasn't just, I suppose, events in your life can seem random at some point. This, for like an hour and a half, that character did seem arbitrary. It was like, it doesn't really go anywhere. But, you know, because this is based on his own life, yeah, okay, then it makes sense to include this character who apparently hit on Robinson on a film he did before.
An Italian director or something, right? He kind of took that from him.
Zeffirelli. He was in that film. Juliet.
I thought that it was slow. And their kind of events or kind of the things that happen, they seem maybe cliche now because obviously I've seen a bunch of films from like the kind of the ones that focus on the 60s era, especially like the amount of Jimi Hendrix that was stuffed into this, although it was two parts. I was like, okay, this does seem cliche, but it's only because of when I watched this film. If I had seen maybe before, I wouldn't think so. So it's just kind of a little late that I saw this film.
I think to address the Monty point, I think because the Monty thing's interesting because, yeah, you're right, maybe it's just because he actually existed and they wanted it to sort of feel real. But coming back to the sort of the thing I mentioned about, you know, finding new meaning in it now,
I think I sort of understood the Monty character a bit more now as well. I used to think he was kind of included just for comic effect because he's this hilarious, you know, closeted homosexual kind of, you know, this character that I think everyone sort of knows in British society. I think now I get that he's kind of like, he's past it. He's like over the hill and he always talks about his like glory years and he's quite a pathetic figure because he's so far beyond them. And he always remembers his 20s and his glorious time, and you never really see any of it, obviously, but you get a sense of it. And he kind of is there to remind you that, like, you know, being a kind of tragic 29-year-old is one thing, but if you continue in that way, then you end up really quite tragic. You have regrets and you're sort of clinging onto your past.
And he does kind of like try to be one of the guys in a sense, like in a very almost pathetic way. He's way over the hill and stuff, and he's kind of like more of a father figure to them, whether they see
it's a source of income, whether or not that's money or escape.
It's like it's a two-way relationship because they just sort of exploit him for the money and the house and all that stuff, but he kind of, what he's getting from them is this kind, he's like reliving his glory years by sort of you know, trying to make himself feel young again, which is quite tragic.
To be honest, I was kind of just laughing at Monty every time he was in a scene.
Oh, my boy.
I was just going to quickly jump back to Bruce, because it seems like he enjoys having a drink while he writes, and it was just kind of an interesting read, this article with him and about kind of what alcohol has meant to him throughout his life, not necessarily in a detrimental way, just how it's become part of his creative process. The way he put it was like a glass of wine like lubricates the wheels, and and he made a good point of like, you go to a party and for the first hour no one's really drinking and everyone's a bit stiff, and then as soon as everyone's drinking, everyone's laughing and joking. He's like, I want to get in that headspace when I'm writing, because then I can see the characters. And there's just a different way in on the creative process.
Yeah, it's like alcohol doesn't just destroy you, it can actually unlock stuff, I guess, in the right.
There's
quite a famous I don't know if you ever watched Mitchell and Webb. You know Mitchell and Webb, the guys in the beach show? They do a sketch where it's like this barrister is really nervous before his like first big court appearance. And this kind of mysterious figure comes and like recruits him, and it's meant to be a little bit the Freemasons. And he's like, hello, sir, how are you? And it's like, we're going to let you into a club. And so he invites him into this kind of special club. And basically it's this kind of Freemason type thing where the club is just under two glasses of wine. So, and like their secret is that everyone performs their best when they're just about to finish their second glass of wine.
That's hilarious. That's such a funny insight.
And it's so true, right? If you've had just two glasses of wine, you feel like you can conquer the world. So probably for a short period of time, it makes you very creative.
It's hard to read any articles with Bruce or about Bruce without the mention of alcohol. So that kind of tells you how, not how much alcohol he consumes, but how it's fused with his work. He seems to be like definitely just using it for work almost. At some points, because like the Rum Diary, when he was writing that, he said he couldn't get a word out. So he was like, I think he was pretty strict with maybe like he had a bottle a day or something like that. But then he wrote it in no time. I definitely agree. It does. It just kind of makes you less self-conscious about, you know, your writing and the fact that you know you're staring at this at a white page, and anything you will write when you're sober, you'll just keep. As a creator, I think you will just keep saying to yourself that it's not still as good as it could be.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, especially with writing, you know, it's a solitary thing most of the time. So it's interesting how he kind of attributes that with writing. And then obviously with directing, you've got to be on set and present.
But it's very, it's definitely a divisive film. I mean, yes. I read earlier also that apparently the producer, so the guy from... There was a guy from the studio called Handmade Films or something. And apparently he nearly shut down the production on the first day because he just didn't think it was funny. At the end of the first day, he was like, we're going to kill this.
I heard that if the crew laughed at any jokes, he would be cut and repeat. And he always felt that that was a good measure of what would be funny and what wouldn't. Which I think is a real testament to the kind of singular... like trust and cinematic experience that he hoped one person would have in watching this film, that you're not necessarily going to this film and watching it opening night, like opening night, laughing with everyone, you're kind of, even if you watch it at home by yourself, you can still find it funny. I mean, I burst out laughing a number of times, and I watched it alone.
Yeah.
I just think that goes to show that decision he made actually shone through, because it's easy to go for the easy laughs.
It's harder
to create an atmosphere.
It is what British humor, kind of much very dry at points. But it also shows how little faith some of the producers had in this film, because obviously he had to put 30 grand of his own money for that scene in the car.
Yeah.
And when the police chase him. Yeah. Well, that was the biggest chase I've ever seen. But yeah, and I don't know why, but you know that second policeman, the one that says get in the back of the car. Why did he have that voice?
I was like, yeah, I don't know why.
it's so random.
Such a like 60s British copper.
It felt like an extra trying to just stand out going to be a masterpiece film.
I did find that weird.
It's a good point. Like, it's not, and actually maybe that's also the two films that I'm talking about. So this film is two different films. It's like on the one hand, it's just a quotable laugh a minute, really funny thing on the surface, and then actually it's got a deeper sort of poignant and actually quite sad meaning to it. It's a black comedy, so you're not meant to just slapstick laugh at everything.
Yeah.
That doesn't come through until later in the film. That more dark, kind of agonizing thing to watch with him. I was just going to say, on the production side of stuff, apparently this film features a rare appearance of a recording by the Beatles, because
George Harrison.
George Harrison was a producer, or probably an exec producer on the film. I think he was the one that allowed the song to be used, "While My Guitar Gently Weeps," which I think is played when they drive back to London, right?
No,
apparently
it's in the bath. I think it's like it's when he's in the bath shaving. I think Jimi Hendrix is when they're coming back.
Also, apparently, don't know how much of this is true, but as far as Robinson said, he's like the only reason George Harrison even got involved with this, because somebody, I can't remember, they said they found the script on the plane or something. It was just like the most random thing. Like, he would never come on board because he wouldn't have ever heard of it.
Mm.
Even though, like, Robinson, obviously, he kind of used to hang out with those kind of people that would become much more influential way later. So, like, Ralph Steadman apparently was one of the friends, close friends of his, which kind of links back to stuff like Rum Diaries, stuff like that.
Because
obviously that's Hunter S. Thompson.
Was he just printing scripts out and leaving them on planes, hoping that someone with a huge connection?
That is a solid strategy, though.
We've all tried that. So apparently with Nell, there was nearly a few different actors.
Richard E. Grant was saying that he was the last choice or something.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis, Bill Nighy, Ken Branagh, pretty big name.
How different would it have been, though?
Yeah, very different. He was perfect for it.
Well, yeah, because also, I'm surprised, I don't know if you guys saw this, but it was him and Paul McGann's film debut. So it was their first films as actors. He probably related with the script a little bit probably quite a lot in terms of, you know, out of work actor trying to get work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they wanted some people who were new. Although, yeah, and then he said, this guy Bruce, he's obviously, like, you know, talented. He was giving that talk and about how he nearly, how he did fire Paul McGann just because he sounded too Liverpudlian.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, man, you hired him when he sounded Liverpudlian. It's quite harsh to then be like, yeah, we can't have you anymore.
I think there was quite a telling thing he said, where he said that there was no improvisation on the film. It was exactly how it was written, word for word.
Of course, he would say that, wouldn't he? Not.
Yeah. Well, no, it was Richard E. Grant was saying there was no... I love how I keep calling him Richard E. Grant, just Richard.
Full naming him for.
I don't know why I'm full naming him. Was saying that, yeah, literally not a comma or a full stop wasn't said that was on the script. It goes to show the authenticity of Bruce's autobiographical kind of nature of the whole story, but maybe just that he just didn't want actors having control by improvising, you know?
Yeah,
I think it's the whole thing of him being an author, that authors are generally pretty precious about their work. That's why producers don't like authors adapting their own work, because usually they're too precious and it comes usually in a 300-page script that, you know, you're never going to film that. With him, I can see that why, because obviously he's a bigger author than he is a director, even though he's obviously well known for this film. But I think it's because he's written just more as an author than obviously as a director.
Yeah.
So I think that's where that kind of comes from. Side note, did you guys know that this is Colin Farrell's favourite film?
Apparently it's a lot of people's favourite film.
Funny.
And not surprised, but yeah.
Supposedly David Fincher is a massive fan of this, and as in Alien 3, tried to create like an unofficial reunion where he cast McGowan and another character from With Neo and I. It might have been Uncle Monty, I think. And he did try to cast Richard E. Grant, but he declined the role. So they would have had all three of them in the same in Alien 3.
I mean, it doesn't seem like Richard E. Grant would have had a good time out of this film.
Probably not.
Like, he'd never drunk before, and then he was like forced to drink, even though he was allergic to alcohol. I think your memories of that probably wouldn't be that fond, would they?
Johnny Depp apparently hired Robinson because he saw Whitnet. And he was like, have you ever read Rum Diaries? Yeah, that's how that kind of came about to be.
It was so interesting watching this, knowing it was shot in 1987, but the fact that there was nothing in the film that betrayed the fact that it was it was meant to show 1969.
That's true.
It almost kind of shows you either how little Camden has moved on in like 15 years, or just how well the production design was. But I just felt like there was nothing in the film that betrayed that it was almost 1990 when they shot this.
Yeah,
it's kind of insane,
especially on a small budget. Smaller.
For some reason, I was thinking that it's the 80s, and I was like, obviously I wasn't here, but I was like, man, London looks fucking old as shit for the 80s.
Yeah, we modernized really quickly in the 90s.
People came over and built skyscrapers within 2 years.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think actually that's one of the nicest things about that film. It's you kind of get a window into London life in the 60s, which is quite cool, with the music as well.
I was just amazed how the motorway signs don't look any different.
Like, yeah.
They still look the same.
They're still the same. It's like, I literally was like, Tenet? What's going on here? <I'm> like, just going back to Uncle Monty, and I don't know what you guys think, what slightly threw me was just kind of thinking, like, what would this film be like without him and this side story in it? Like, did it need it? Did it add anything to the kind of takeout that I had of the film, which was that this is a kind of a tragic loss of, like, youth and wasted potential?
Well, I think, and weirdly coming from a person who, out of the three of us, probably liked it the least, this is my takeaway from it, and that is, so you have three generations essentially of this kind of avidus potential that you can go and make something of yourself, or you don't and you drink yourself to death, or you just still chase your youth. So hopefully, because he was hitting hard on Uncle Monty, was hitting hard on what was the guy, Paul's
and
character,
I
right. So he kind of like forced him to kind of actually do something with, don't just end up like Rich's character, obviously, yeah. Because without him, Rich's character, I think, would have just dragged him along.
The thing that I think's really clever about With Neil and I touched on it before, is a bit like, it's a personal story about the end of your 20s, but it's also a really kind of like, it's a story about the country at the end of the 60s, like leaving this era behind of chaos and anarchy and, you know, whatever we want to do, we'll do. And Monty, so if With Neil and Paul McGann's character are kind of the examples of the 60s that are coming to an end, Monty is the kind of the old Britain from before the 60s. Like, Monty is the kind of the empire and, you know, Cole Porter, and it's that sort of like 30s 40s glory that felt really old-fashioned in the 1960s. Yeah.
Very
whereas
true.
Now the 1960s guys are quickly being consigned to history, and they're starting to feel it as well. So it's sort of like showing how things are moving on. There's a line that he uses, I just looked it up, where he goes, they're walking around in Penrith, and he goes, oh, my boys, we are at the end of an age. We live in a land of weather forecasts and breakfasts that set in, shat on by Tories, shovelled up by Labour. And here we are, we three, perhaps the last island of beauty in the world. And it's this kind of, I'm clinging on to the past. Times have moved on.
Yeah, I mean, his car was, surely that wasn't a 60s car. The one he was driving, it looked
yeah,
way,
good point. He drives like a sort of 40s Rolls Royce or something, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I think it's a Jaguar. Yeah, that's a very interesting read.
There can be no true beauty without decay. Yeah.
A lot of the film kind of is decay, the way that they live in their flat. Mm. And this film, for me, on the cinematography level, was so good, is that it is really hard to shoot something that looks desolate and is kind of getting across like desolation. in a way that it's not about it looking nice, but in a way that kind of actually accentuates that and doesn't just show it for what it is. And I think this film did that really well. Also really like some of the camera moves. The camera was just moving around sometimes, like when he was in the bath and he was shaving. That was such a cool profile shot of him. And then it cuts to this kind of almost like a play angle, like you're in the audience. Like this could have run as a play, right? I'm sure it probably has over the years, but there's just enough cinematic elements to the way it's shot that elevates it from just being this cruddy flat they live in to this kind of epic journey that they go on a little bit. It's really well shot film for considering the subject matter.
And considering it's shot in like a tiny flat.
Tiny flat, for a lot of it. No money. Yeah. And even the shots when they're walking down Regent's Park and the camera's just tracking along next to them. It's not a lot, but it makes it look like it's got a lot more budget than it probably had, to be honest.
Well, what was the budget? $1 million. I mean, this is the '80s, like you a couple of years more and you have the Terminator coming out. Maybe around this time actually. You're right, some of the camera techniques are very elaborate. So especially the one that you just mentioned, him in the bathtub. Some of the moves are completely just like the shit you do when you pull out a phone these days, where it's just like almost not in a sense boring, but they are very flat.
They let the actors just act and live in the frame. I mean, it must have been a real joy to have acted in this because you were just given the space to perform. You know, think about the movies of the 80s and the 90s. It was quite a lot of action movies, quite cutty. It probably stood out quite a lot. You know, that's why it feels like a play a little bit, because it's just they're on a wide a lot of the time.
Quick question. Do you both find the whole bull situation funny?
The which situation?
The bull. Like, you know, get the ball, get the ball. That felt slapstick for me, which I was like, I hate slapstick, to be fair. Really not my type thing at all. So for me, that those weird moments that, because for, like, this is an indie film, as we know, but some of the, if it had shied away maybe from those slapstick moments, maybe I think I might have liked it more. But also even the way Monty guy he hits on I's character, where he's just like, it does come across as slapstick sometimes, especially when they're in the cottage I think, and he just kind of not kneeling over him, or he's kind of towering him by looking for what was it, food or a product in the bag. He's like, oh, maybe it's one bag, maybe it's in the other. I don't know.
It's funny then, isn't it? It's like, it's when they're playing for laughs that it sometimes just feels a little bit.
But the comedy for me is just like, it's so quotable. Like even from the start when he's like, my heart's beating like a fucked clock. It's like, who says that?
It's so
funny. Like
it's just because it's really well written.
Drug dealer, Dan, you know, the guy who
made
Danny the dealer.
When he's just like offering him drugs and Richard E. Grant's like, balls, I'll swallow it and run a mile. The confidence of him.
This is the Camberwell carrot, my friend. Very, very wrong word.
He's like, hair is what gets in the way of the government reading your mind. That's why balls are so uptight. It's like, what?
Oh, Jesus. And that's what hooks you originally, isn't it? It's just the quotes. There's so many quotes. I demand some booze.
And like, obviously the famous line of like, we want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here and we want them now.
Yeah. We are millionaires.
The note on the cottage door, and it was like, here, hair, here.
Here.
That was so funny. That's the thing, like with the script is really well written. For me, the last scene when he was saying him goodbye, that was the part where I was like, oh, it all kind of came together a little bit. Not necessarily in a logical plot sense, but just in a sense that this is where this film was heading. And this was like, this was kind of the point it was trying to make. I also read something that I thought was quite poetic, and that the rain kind of sounds like an applause. You know, rain features quite a lot in this film. It rains kind of in a huge amount of scenes, and I feel like I don't know if that was ever the initial intention, but it's a really nice addition, I think.
Bit of a spoiler, but I guess that ship sailed in the book.
We're literally 40 minutes in and we're like, spoilers!
Yeah. No, but in the book, at the end, Withnail kills himself. Obviously, in the film, I guess they didn't want to go that far, but that Hamlet soliloquy, that what a piece of work is man, that is a suicidal thing. I mean, it's him in Hamlet, it's him explaining to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern that he's feeling suicidal. So there's a kind of open-endedness there where, you know, maybe he's going off to go and kill himself, or maybe it's just a depressing ending.
I mean,
but it's an interesting...
Yeah, that is interesting. I did you guys get the sense that with Nell was possibly the better actor as well? Like, there's even more of a potential loss kind of talent.
The bigger tragedy there, yeah.
I definitely got a sense that maybe it's like there's different eras of acting though. Well, like the old sort of like, you know, 50s rep sort of theatre lot would all be kind of old Etonians kind of, you know, prancing around in tights doing Shakespeare. But obviously, like, you know, the stuff that the And I character, that Paul McGann's character is doing is modern stuff. It's like adverts and like he gets a part in a film in the end, doesn't he? Which sounds like quite a modern film. Whereas Richard E. Grant's character with Nell is offered like the understudy for some Greek tragedy. And it's like they're very different kinds of people. And I guess the fact that Paul McGann's character is the one that sort of succeeds in the end, and with Nell's character is the one that doesn't, again, is this reference to, like, you know, Britain is for the modern comprehensive school lot, not for the old Etonians anymore. If only that were true.
You get the sense that Bruce Robinson's quite politically motivated in what he writes and what he wants to explore.
Yeah, he's very anti-establishment, isn't he, though?
But I guess it's part of the genius of the writing, I think, that he connects the personal with the national story, you know, like what's kind of going on at large as well as what's happening with these two friends. Apparently, I just read as well, apparently in one of the early drafts of the screenplay, Withmer was going to commit suicide.
I think it would have been a too dark ending to a film that... It would have killed that feeling at the end of the loss of potential and wastedness, because you would have actually seen them go through with it. You can take your own ending out. You kind of hope that maybe he will go off and become a great actor. You know, you don't necessarily are given the ending. I like the ambiguity a little bit. I think I always prefer films that have a slightly ambiguous ending like that. It helps you fill in the blanks yourself. Plus, it would have been so dark.
Yeah, too dark.
But that's the sense I got anyways.
It would have been about that.
If it wasn't suicide, it would have been alcohol anyways, because he was so against change, but this is not he was going to change anytime quick. Mm. And, you know, that amount of alcohol and whatever kind of drugs he takes. If you just think for a second of what the outside of this film would be, so like once the credits roll, and if you did see him in the street, where do you think he would go? Probably to get booze or get loaded or whatever. And, you know, he wouldn't think about changing to the way Paul's character changed, because he even says that, like, oh, there's always time for a drink, and he's like, no, I don't have time.
It's also kind of, because it's there's a tragedy to it, but it's also kind of like affectionate. I don't know, the film's overall tone isn't like, oh good, look, oh god, look how horrible our lives were back then. There is a kind of nostalgia to it as well.
Yeah, I wonder if this is why it's a lot of people's favorite film, because it kind of, like you were saying earlier, it captures a certain era so well.
The tragedy isn't really that it was happening. The tragedy is that it's over. Do you know what I mean? Like the reason it's set at the end of the 60s is it's like you get the sense that actually these guys, right, they have a loving, really strong friendship, albeit slightly kind of dysfunctional. They've obviously had the time of their lives during the 60s, right? So they've lived in this flat, they've got this network of friends, they've been high the whole time, drinking the whole time, and like you get this sense that actually, like, they have had glorious times together. You're just seeing the very last sort of few days of it, and that makes it quite nostalgic.
I think I'd agree with that point as well.
That really opens it up for me, actually, that kind of looking at it from that angle.
Yeah, because he's only kind of showing you the end of it. And I mean, he's not being morose about it either. He's just like, this is how it went. Sure, some people changed, some people didn't. So obviously, the Wood's character, he's dead, died at 50, I think. So yeah, he's not being morbid about it or being all that depressive. If he was, it wouldn't be so funny for some people, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think he's looking back at it fondly rather than just like, oh well, that was the end of that, and now we all went to die. No, it was much more.
And I guess that's why suicide would have made it worse, because suicide just sort of makes it, oh, it was a terrible story. Like, oh, it's a bad.
I think, like you said, it would have overshadowed the other themes and kind of other political points in the film. Random fact, did you know that there's a famous drinking game associated with the film, which is you take a drink and Withnell takes a drink. And according to this, if you do that, Withnell is shown roughly drinking 9.5 glasses of red wine, 1/2 imperial pint of cider, 1 shot of lighter fluid or vinegar or overproof rum are common substitutes for this part, 2.5 measures of gin, 6 glasses of sherry, 13 drams of Scotch whiskey, I don't even know what a dram is, and 1/2 a pint of ale. So if you if you drink with him, so yeah, anyone who
I remember
drinking in lockdown, Jesus, this film on.
I do remember at school always like swearing we were going to do that. I do remember talking about that before, but obviously we never did because I'm still alive.
Good indication there.
Do we have a? It was all a dream for this film.
I don't. I struggled to come up with anything then. They were just drunk. That's it.
I really struggled with It Was All a Dream this time.
It's a bit hard.
I have one theory about this film. It Was All a Dream, which is, and it seems a bit obvious maybe, but that possibly Andai's character is not actually real and is just a figment of Withnail's imagination.
One of the
reasons why I got to this was because when they're in the cottage and Monty and Withnail are like getting on really well across the table, there's these shots where it shows Paul McGann, like looking at them being like, is no one listening to me? Like, is no one here? And I started thinking about this more and I was like, maybe when they're in the pub and that guy says to, you know, that guy starts on, he goes up to him, he's like, you mac fuck, that Irish guy. I wonder if it's because he went to the pub by himself and was just being like a nuisance. He rationalized it by being like, oh, he's taking the piss out of this imaginary guy with flares on or whatever. But actually, like, he just got thrown out of the pub himself. It's quite funny. The more I thought about it, the more I was like, maybe Withnail is exactly the kind of character who would take his uncle's Jaguar and drive to a cottage in the middle of nowhere by himself and just prance around drunk and kind of invent this other person with them to like act opposite to try and run scenes with. I mean, it's basically like applying Fight Club to this film, but it was quite funny.
I feel like you could apply Fight Club to a lot of films, to be fair.
Yeah.
I guess you could. But then again, David Fincher is a fan of this film, so you know, maybe there's a.
There has to be a sequel one day.
With Nail and You. Yeah. It would be like With Nail and Us. Jesus.
Abby's gonna hate me for saying this, but because I was talking about it, the film, you know, a couple of times, because obviously we were going to do this, and she asked me the other day who played Nail. And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah, the film's called With Nail and I.
Yeah,
fair enough. I can totally see that.
I wonder how many people have made that mistake.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was called With Neil. So I
with Neil and I.
That's why when I was looking up on Amazon, I couldn't find it. It was just kept coming up wrong.
You just found the straight to DVD sequel that was in 1997. When none of
they didn't get the rights, so they had to change it.
I've never heard a name called With Nail, so I was like, fair enough.
Yeah, I do wonder why he's called With Nail. Is there any reason behind this? I mean, because Vivian Mackerel, I think, was the real With Nail.
Yeah, I don't know. Good point.
Richard E. Grant he wrote a book called With Nails, I think, which was his kind of take on it. So people are stretching this word in different ways. That's for sure. But yeah, I think this might be one of the most cult classic films we've done on the pod.
So far, at least.
Yeah.
So far, yeah.
And definitely one that didn't, I don't know if we've done this before, but definitely one that wasn't popular when it was in the cinema. Like, it failed really at the cinema. It was more of a sort of video release thing, wasn't it, when it started to become popular.
I actually, it's funny, but we're talking about this. I read something recently where Spike Lee was saying that he actually thinks cult films are ones that never do well on theatrical release. And
that's a good point.
Yep. The more you think about it, I mean, going back to not to try and weave It Was All a Dream into the end of this episode, but Fight Club was a commercial failure. And there are a lot of movies which don't do well and then become cult films. And in a way, a lot of things become cult, like With Nail, because they were so hard to actually, apparently it was so hard to even get hold of when it came out. So although it had a small theatrical run, it was then just kind of like not shown to a lot of people for a while. So that almost cements it more in the mind of like, oh, I saw this great film, but you can't see it anywhere. You know, that makes it
cult.
In the 90s, I think a lot of producers and film kind of mined the cult thing to make it its own mainstream thing.
In the 90s, though, wasn't there more of a kind of renaissance for these indie small films? So everyone was looking for those indie films, like even Fight Club is still, although it was backed by a major studio, it's still considered a small indie film.
Like Clerks as well.
Clerks, exactly. Yeah. Great Res Dogs, you know.
Are we saying that the way to make a cult film is to make your film,
and
print it on one DVD, and then just like throw it off your balcony,
send it on a plane to LA,
yeah,
in a bottle,
first class seat for your DVD.
Get washed in
It was a really great film to do, and it was, I think it's really cool to see something that's so steeped in British culture and kind of like you were saying a little bit, revisit it at a later age. I feel like you kind of need to be, maybe you need to be the same age as the characters to kind of enjoy what it is.
It unlocks something for sure.
Yeah. Oh, it makes sense a little bit, that kind of aspect. I forgot a few years until I get to Whitnail's age, so it doesn't resonate that strongly.
Watch it again.
Yeah.
Ooh, a couple years. Swallow it and run a mile. I love that line. I'm gonna have to use that at some point. I think in maybe a lot of ways this film is as close as you can get to visualizing a hangover as possible.
Well, Fisherman's Friends is quite good for that as well.
We should actually say, because I don't know if we've ever clarified this. Fisherman's Friends with Daniel Mays in, who was also in White Lines, this TV series.
He looked so hungover.
In Fisherman's Friends, and there is actually a scene where he wakes up hungover after the pub.
He's just got a hungover vibe about him, this guy.
he's gonna be with Nails in Us as the
with Nails in Us, the hangover.
Yeah. All right, guys. I don't know what our next film is. I think we will probably let... I know that I was going to let Sparrow have a go at choosing what would be the next film, so I don't know if we're going to get hit with like a Deer Hunter or something, but sure.
He did message me about that. He's like, have you seen Deer Hunter? I'm like, yeah. But then he just left it at that. He didn't say anything else.
That's Sparrow. That's hilarious. I can imagine how that goes down. Exactly, just like turning up at your door being like, have you seen Deer Hunter? What are you doing here, man? All right, gotta go.
Yeah, given that I live like the furthest away from anyone. Fucking jokes.
Turns up in Scotland and Louis like, have you seen Deer Hunter? Sparrow, if you're listening, we miss you. Come back on the next episode.
Gotta be done.
Sparrow's like, balls, I swallowed and run a mile. I'm on to have some booze. Everyone take care. We'll see you on the next episode. It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Louis.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Benass.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from Sparrow. Okay.
Terrible.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.